Welcome to Why Wars Happen, History Podcast, where we sit with filmmakers and historians and authors, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Shannon Monaghan, who is a war historian, has worked at the U.S. State Department, and was a professor of writing at Harvard, and is the author of A Quiet Company of Dangerous Men, The Forgotten British Special Operations Soldiers of World War II. Shannon, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you so much for having me.
Yes, so that title, wow, how did you pick that title? That just stands out so much.
I feel like titles are the hardest part of writing anything, honestly. So it was an iterative process. I think, honestly, my editor really should get most credit for it, Teresa Sissel. But I had come up with a list playing on the ideas of how long their experience fighting was, both in World War II specifically and then throughout the Cold War. So yeah. The idea of company, both of a company of fellows, obviously, but also a company is a military unit, obviously, as well. This idea, these were very effective and, I guess, dramatically dangerous men. And obviously from the epigraph, which is actually from T.E. Lawrence's memoir, Lawrence of Arabia, he mentions the idea of men who can act their dreams in the day in real life to make them happen, that these are dangerous men. And so they all kind of came together in A Quiet Company of Dangerous Men.
It really does sum up kind of the feel of when you're reading it and you're like, wow, this really does feel like this James Bondy slip in, slip out, really dangerous guys. And it's really funny. We were talking a little bit before we started the recording here about how relatively unknown the SOE is in comparison to how Europe kind of is a lot more familiar with them, obviously, because Britain. But how did you come across the SOE? How did you get so involved in this research?
Yeah, it was a strangely modern story, I think. I had been on Amazon buying books, as one does. And in that little you might also like category came up one of Peter Kemp's memoirs, and Peter Kemp is one of the four men we kind of really follow through this book. And it was actually about his time fighting in Spain, which I really didn't know that much about. Kind of a preface, Peter Kemp was actually one of the very few Westerners who fought for the nationalists in Spain, though he was, to make very clear, certainly not a fascist. He was a romantic. He'd actually joined a royalist unit, of all things, when the war broke out as an anti-communist. And I never heard anything about anyone who had done that. And so I pick up this memoir and then realize how many other things he had done across World War II and throughout the Cold War, and realize all these other people he'd been fighting with, and just fell into that rabbit hole.
It is kind of a rabbit hole. And just real quick for our audience that might not be familiar with the SOE, that is the Special Operations Executive, also called SOE, because it's kind of a mouthful if you say the whole thing. And it was like, and the way that you described it was that in the early years of World War II, Winston Churchill put them on a mission to, quote, set Europe ablaze. And they're basically supposed to drum up revolts in enemy territory, gather intelligence, blow up things, basically anything to be a thorn in the side of the Nazis. Is that fair?
Yeah, a very fair assessment. I think one of the reasons why fewer people, particularly here, don't really know about SOE is because it was very effective during the war, but he didn't survive it. And it was essentially shut down in the aftermath of the war, and that went over to SIS, also known as MI6. But yeah, I think Americans frequently forget how long the British stood alone, before Pearl Harbor, before we entered the war, and they're kicked out of Europe. Dunkirk has happened, and they're really backs against the wall, and forming these special operations units that would allow them to punch above their weight was, really one of their few options very early on. And so the British, ironically enough, the British Empire formed units of two of the things that had been fighting against quite desperately for a very long time, right? Guerrillas and saboteurs, very intentionally. And they were dropped behind enemy lines as both dangerous men in very dangerous situations, right? You didn't have an extraction plan when you got dropped into these places.
Oh, yeah.
To essentially cause as much trouble for the Nazis as they could.
Yeah, it was really reading your book and then kind of going down that rabbit hole myself. It was like, holy crap, the things that the SOE was doing really was 007. It really was, but like grittier, yeah, almost, you know. And you mentioned Peter Kemp, and I want to talk about him. He is so fascinating. So he's like a real life action figure, parachute drops and raids and anti-communists and communists and captured by the Soviets at one point. This guy was like a war machine. And he, I wanted to ask you real quick about his time in Spain before World War II. So there's the Spanish Civil War.
Julian Amory runs into Peter Kemp. They meet in a ditch, sheltering from shelling. Exactly. So Julian's a bit younger and becomes very well known, yeah, as a conservative MP after the war, and eventually joins this team of men in Albania. But yes, they meet these men in a ditch. Peter Kemp was already there, having, you know, joined this royalist unit well before Franco became kind of, you know, the head of everything.
Okay.
But yes, Peter Kemp, I think I've said, was the combat instincts of a pirate and the manners of a prince. He really was. A lot of people who knew him said, you know, Peter was one of the last true, you know, knight errants. And he...
It definitely does seem like from a different era, different kind of person. Almost, I don't want to say glorified, but like kind of this person that you really don't see anymore, that you can really look to go, how did this person exist? How do they even put themselves in these situations? And then we're talking about the Spanish Foreign Legion, right? So
yes,
you said their motto was Viva la Muerte, long live death. Like that's a choice of words.
Indeed. And ironically enough, it's called the Spanish Foreign Legion. And it is mostly full of Spaniards. He ended up transferring into that unit later in the war, and said later that he was very lucky that he didn't go and... initially, when he joined as a private, because he eventually became an officer later, some of the toughest soldiers in Spain. But I think what also always, Peter Kemp was extremely severely wounded in Spain. He nearly died. He was hit by a mortar and then he blew out part of his jaw and basically destroyed most of his teeth. And the medic who sent him off said, you know, when I sent you off in that ambulance to Saros, I never thought that you would live. But he did. He underwent multiple operations to the back of his throat, essentially without anesthesia. There is no way at the time to essentially gag him. A very tough man, but also a sensitive soul. So when Kemp returned to England, you know, this is 1938, 39, obviously everyone can see the writing on the wall in Europe, but the war hasn't started, obviously, formally until Hitler invades Poland in September. But you know, by then, it was not very popular, obviously, to have fought for Franco in Spain for obvious reasons. But when the war broke out, what Peter wrote, I won't get this quote exactly right, was, "My only hope, knowing the reality of conflict and what it meant to fight one, was that the skills that I had gained and faced so much opprobrium for at home would not be of, you know, completely lost to my country." And so he was relegated, oh, to postal censorship and then ultimately found his way into a commando unit and then eventually into SOE.
So how did that happen? Where the leading the Spanish, there was a platoon that he was in,
yeah,
charge
he was
of?
Yeah, he was an officer, the Alferez.
How did that, how did that even happen? Like this guy, and then he gets blown up, part of his fingers are gone, mm-hmm, he's on opioids, and...
Well, yeah, at that point, there's very little, there's not a lot of very good pain medication, you know, which led a lot of people at the time to use alcohol as your only option. He went into one of those operations,
totally,
with a bottle of brandy that apparently he shared with the surgeon. But he spoke no Spanish when he arrived, he learned it. And obviously continued to speak fluent Spanish, you know, eventually worked his way up to officer. I think he would have said that this was one of those situations in which the British, then respect for the British class system kind of worked in his favor, because it was very common at university and in the public high schools, and public in the British sense, right? So fancy private,
okay,
school, to give certificates in what we would call like an ROTC equivalent, so that kind of like a cadet certificate. So he had those.
Oh.
And when he showed up and kind of, you know, gave them over, it allowed him to, I think, have a little bit of an easier leg in. But he essentially just had to kind of learn on his own.
Wow, this guy, he's so be honest, is he just like maybe a little bit Terminator? Did you find any sort of thing about, you know, the T-1000 or anything?
He survived, I think, that Peter had more in lives than a cat would have been yeah. more. He was, as you pointed out. So he fights with Franco against, obviously, both the Spanish Republic and with their Soviet backers in Spain. And when he is eventually dropped into occupied Albania, they're actually sent to a unit of communists. And so here you have a man who's obviously, you know, brave enough to be sent to the men that he had been fighting against, one of the Albanians who was kind of right-hand man to Enver Hoxha, who eventually became dictator of Albania until his death in the mid-80s, had fought in Spain on the other side, right?
How bizarre. This guy, so he's, after the war, he ends up running guns in Laos. He's over in Bali, Thailand. Do you think he just kind of thrived on chaos? Like,
I think he had a very particular skill set. And I think, obviously, so he left, you know, Cambridge. He'd graduated from Cambridge just as the war in Spain was starting. So this is obviously 1936. And then he went straight into the Second World War. He fought in Albania. He went to Poland. This is where he was rounded up by the NKVD, Stalin's secret police. They were supposed to be, you know, handing themselves over to allies as the Red Army moves moves westward, and were promptly thrown into jail that had been taken over from the Gestapo 2 days before. Fought in then occupied, you know, Thailand just before the end of the war, became military governor of Bali, as you pointed out. By the time he was sent home from the war, it was 1946, he had spent 10 years fighting. Wow. And I think all four of them, which was Peter Kemp, Julian Amory, David Smiley, and Billy McLean, I think unfortunately got to see just kind of how quickly what looked like a war just against Hitler was really a war against totalitarianism more broadly. And they had, unfortunately, a front row seat to the Soviet version of that. And he just never stopped fighting. Though Peter Kemp had a very unofficial role in much of the Cold War that was always very deniable, I think is fair to say.
He had a role, maybe not. And then he, at the end, he was selling life insurance and writing books. And do you think that was kind of like some catharsis for him to finally sit down and be like, I'm going to write about everything?
I think there was a wonderful habit amongst, I think, this generation more broadly of publishing memoirs, of making sure that those stories got told. There was a real richness to that in Britain after the war. And several of them had published memoirs, which was obviously selfishly very helpful to me. Though what I found most interesting about, you know, Kemp in that particular instance. So obviously there are things that you can't say. Partially that's a British libel law issue, and also partially these are operational security issues. But the little breadcrumbs that he left. So Peter Kemp, for example, was in Budapest in 1956 during, you know, the rising against the Soviets. It was brutally repressed. And he was nominally there working as a journalist, but did kind of leave these clues in his memoir of, but he never filed those stories because they never got published. But somehow someone was paying for the gas for the car that he used to evacuate these three, you know, student dissidents who'd been, you know, fighting the secret police. So
breadcrumbs. You just put pieces
together. Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to ask you next about David Smiley. These guys are all similar in a way, but this guy had his own kind of slick, like, feels like he could parachute into Albania playing the violin in a tuxedo. I don't know. And he like owned a private jet at one point. And this guy, this guy was like James Bond. Okay. And he came from a military family where his father had fought in World War I and his grandfather was also a soldier. Do you think that that influenced the kind of man that he became?
Yeah, for certain. So David Smiley was absolutely the soldier, just like really kind of the best at it, and did all sorts of incredibly, you know, dangerous things, including, you know, he was their demolitions expert, you know, shaping their own, you know, charges to blow bridges like it's the guns of Navarone, and you know, at the rank of major. There are some stories that, you know, I wasn't able to expand upon enough. You know, he would go undercover in German uniform to do, you know, reconnaissance while they were in Albania, and got into some pretty hairy situations. He was from a very, very well-regarded and aristocratic British family. He did indeed have his pilot's license, which came in handy in Thailand later in the war. And he was part of a very storied cavalry regiment, you know, the Royal Horse Guards, known as the Blues. Like, you know, if you've ever seen any formal British processions down the Mall with those very shiny boots and the hats, that is that unit. They also happen to be extremely serious soldiers, and he really took to war like a fish to water. He was incredibly impressive.
And he did ride behind the Queen during her
coronation
procession,
yeah.
Which, you know, for me, maybe that would even be more nerve-wracking than going to war.
Yeah.
You're like, everybody's looking at you. You have to be perfect.
He was once punished. You. And so he and Billy McLean were slightly older, and so they had both taken up their commissions before the war had started. They'd both been to Sandhurst. And he was once severely admonished because his stirrups had been too long in a procession on the Mall, and he had lost his stirrup. And I noticed when I was his son, Zan, very kindly let me, you know, come to his house and go through David's papers that he had saved. And David Smiley was very good at keeping all of, you know, his records in order and whatnot. But I did notice that, you know, there's the Albania section and everything else about World War II and his service after the war and Oman and Yemen and whatnot. But there was a very large section on the coronation. This is a very, queen and country was incredibly important.
And at that point, everyone is, you're kind of on a stage yourself. And you kind of, like you were saying, the stirrups and, you know, you have to, whereas like his, you know, bread and butter is like blowing up this bridge. There was one other question I had about him was that there was speculation that Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, that the main character was based off of, maybe subconsciously based off of David Smiley. What do you think?
Of George Smiley, of the name. I do know my understanding from David Smiley's biographer was that I guess he had written to Le Carré at one point, you know, asking, you know, because it's also the same spelling. Smiley with an E.
Yeah.
And I think he'd written at one point to inquire, you know, if there was some link here, because he rose quite high in the British military and, you know, became, you know, you would have seen that name kind of printed and whatnot. But I think Le Carré said that he honestly didn't remember, and that he thought he might have gotten off of a school list or whatnot. I mean, I'd always kind of thought
subconsciously.
Yeah. I mean, George Smiley is a very different character. It seemed to me that both David Smiley and Peter Fleming, Ian Fleming's older brother, were both excellent models, quite frankly, as you pointed out, for James Bond. David Smiley,
yeah,
I would like to point out, was a true gentleman, unlike James Bond.
Unlike James Bond, yeah, definitely. So, okay, so the next major character is McLean. So, Billy McLean. So, he was another one, like you're saying, just... he's plucked out of a spy novel. This guy was larger than life. He's in Albania, Yemen, China. Just he was a secret soldier like the other guys. And I kind of was curious, some of the things that we'll kind of get into in a minute here. Do you think that he was an idealist, or was it just something he was really good at?
I think it may have been both. I mean, I think it's certainly true to say that, you know, Billy McLean had an honest-to-goodness international Rolodex of not just contacts, but friends that would have put, you know, foreign ministries and the State Department to shame. So he was, you know, kind of, again, born of a very well-regarded, you know, Scottish, you know, family. He was an officer in the Royal Scots Greys. He had also gone to Sandhurst. You could have also very much, you know, took to war like a fish to water. He and David Smiley had actually met on a troop ship early in the war, when they were trying to join, of all things, the Somaliland Camel Corps, because they'd been sent to the Middle East, and, you know, they were, honestly, they felt like they weren't getting enough of the war quite yet, and so they were trying to transfer over. But that one didn't quite work out. David Smiley ended up in a commando unit, and Billy McLean ended up fighting with the rather infamous Ord Wingate, then a major, in what was then called Abyssinia, Ethiopia. And it was almost instantly obvious that he was one of those born guerrilla leaders. Akito could pick up language or enough of a language rather quickly, very good at relating to other people, was very good at kind of, you know, being able to draw an army to himself, which he did repeatedly in Albania. They had one of the, I thought one of the stranger, more interesting moments of the Second World War, when we think about how global it is, they managed to form almost a company size unit of deserters from then the Germans, who were called the Turkestan Legion. These were Central Asian men who had been essentially conscripted by the Soviet Union, obviously, which is always occupying countries that are now, you know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, etc. They had been captured at the Battle of Kharkov, now Kharkiv in Ukraine, in 1942, I want to say, whether they were captured or whether they had got tired of being used as cannon fodder and had removed themselves from their officers is an open question. But then they decided they no longer liked the way they were being treated by the Germans. And one group that came over thought to provide useful evidence of how they had handled this by a green kerchief in which they were 6 years. So they went over to Billy McLean, who was leading this unit in Albania, and they used them to fight against the Germans in some very interesting paramilitary operations towards the ends of their time there. That's in 1944. Amazing. He was sent to what we now call Xinjiang. Xinjiang was the pronunciation at the time, which is the part of China, Western China, where the Uyghurs live. Mm-hmm. And so he spent 1945 and 46 there making friends and being in interesting places. And he had friends across the Middle East. And himself was also involved in some interesting moments of the Cold War period, including in Yemen.
He could bring people
really
together.
It was a really, really tremendous talent, the kind of the end of the generation of, as Julian Emery, who went to Eton with Billy, or they overlap very briefly, called a Bosibu, the beautiful swordsman.
Okay, so the fact that he was doing all of that, and now also there was early-ish in the war, maybe mid-war, 1943, you have him in Albania, and he's supposed to get, it's kind of an odd mission, like get the communists and the anti-communists to work together and form this kind of cohesive unit to fight the Nazis. And then he left for a little bit of time, was evacuated, and then he came back. And shocker, surprise, surprise, they didn't get along. And Britain had to choose one side, the communists or the anti-communists, and they chose the communists. Why do you think that was? Was it just there was more manpower or...
It was one of these obviously tremendously complicated situations, even more complicated by the fact that when the first two to go into occupied Albania are Billy McLean and David Smiley with a small group of a couple of other officers, these NCOs who are absolutely crucial, they're paramilitary experts, radio operators. They had to walk in from occupied Greece because they have no intelligence on the ground. They have no reception committee because it's been busted by, you know, kind of the Italian and then eventually the German invasion of the Balkans more broadly. So the instructions going in as a brigadier who was eventually sent in would say it sounded deceptively simple. You know, arm anyone who will fight the Germans, because the purpose is to try down as many German units in the Balkans as you can. Because at this point in the war, the Soviets have survived Stalingrad. Hitler's, you know, given up his whole army here, and they're starting to move west. And so what the Allies don't want to do is have all these, the thought was at the time there's about, you know, nearly 30 divisions, maybe 26 divisions in the Balkans broadly. Not, they won't all fit in Albania, to be clear. And you're trying to pin them down so that they can't, you know, go north and become more useful to Hitler's war effort. That said, what they find in Albania is not the Second World War, but multiple Second World Wars. There are essentially a series of civil wars going on between the communists, as you mentioned, a royalist unit called Zagists, who are supporters of the kind of self-made King Zog. Who are very anti-communist, and another group of anti-communists who are Republican nationalists who don't want the communists but also don't want King Zog. So there are all three of them.
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated situation, and I think the ultimate ally choice to go with the communists is for a variety of reasons. One, that choice had already been made in Yugoslavia, and obviously Yugoslavia is far larger, the greater moon of Balkan communism. But there was a complicating factor, in addition to the choices that were made, which was that there was a Soviet mole in their staff office, who hadn't ultimately had relationships with the other men, eventually known as the Cambridge Five, which Kim Philby was probably most famous, who really felt that it was his entire purpose was to execute exactly what you're talking about, to shift Allied support to the communists, not necessarily for the purpose of the war itself, but for the post-war. And so there were more of them. There were some other intentional military and political choices, but there was also this compounding factor of a man called James Kluge.
Yeah, and you go into that a little bit in the book, and I'm going to give Winnie spoilers. So, but for anybody interested in that, that the book does cover that. So on that note, several years later, in the 1950s, maybe a decade later, Billy McLean is now in Parliament. Yes. He's elected as a member of Parliament, and he does this whole thing where he convinces the British government not to ally with the Communist Party in the Northern Yemen territory. And he said that that was like his greatest accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And why was that, of all things, the biggest accomplishment? Do you think?
Yeah. Of so all this things? This is the 60s at this point. And I mean, you kind of think it's the 60s. So Yemen, and what is just south of Yemen, right? So we're now on the western kind of corner, obviously, of the Arabian Peninsula, which, again, so many places that Billy was specifically remain in the news today for a whole variety of reasons. But Yemen was a complicated place that is obviously crucial to international shipping. Even with India being independent, the role of the Suez Canal remains crucial in global shipping. Yemen was rather strange because it was then called the Yemen, legally in the formal names. So that's what you'll see in the book. There were what were called royalists who were being challenged by essentially communist groups who were trying to take over. It was part of a kind of an almost imperial project on the part of the ruler of Egypt at the time, Nasser, right? Who is obviously allied with the Soviets. In a strange moment, this is again one of these strange moments in which the Americans are partially involved, actually, on the Egyptians' side, because there's obviously tensions between royalists aren't, for a variety of reasons, our favorite. But there's also some kind of misunderstanding that this isn't really kind of the popular uprising that you think it is. And it was it's a kind of a crucial part of the world. And I think Billy McLean's point that knowing exactly who you're dealing with is the important thing here, rather than kind of following what is the more fashionable tide. So I think that's what he was going for with that.
Okay, so I did want to make sure we talk about Julian Amory a little bit more before we go here. So he was another one of the four main characters in the book. And he came from this long line of, impressive military heritage, so to speak, where his father was the Secretary of State for India, Burma, the colonies, and he was the first Lord of the Admiralty, which for Americans, he basically was in charge of the British Navy for a while. And after the war, Amory himself became a member of Parliament, and his stepfather was like the Prime Minister at one point of the UK. So he's kind of born into this thing. And do you ever think he just wanted to just run a coffee shop instead?
Julian was born to it. So Julian Amory is a younger son of Leo Amory, who was an incredibly impressive, as you pointed out, statesman in his own right, though really not from a long lineage of it. Leo Amory really was very self-made in and of himself. But Julian Amory, his son, was a true intellectual, I would argue, and just a natural-born politician. Though of a different era, right? More of a natural statesman, I think, than we would say kind of a politician, the way that we talk about politicians today. So kind of, you know, very interested in policy and in Britain's place in the world from a very early age. He eventually became a conservative MP, though his hero growing up was David Lloyd George, the liberal radical, actually. And so he was probably the most thought out in very technical, sophisticated political terms, you know, of the four of them, and was essentially their intelligence officer in Albania. Becomes a conservative MP eventually after the war. His wife was one of the children of Harold Macmillan, who eventually became the prime minister. And Julian Amery, after the war, had a long and rather illustrious career in British politics, you know, like the formal version, kind of alongside Billy McLean, who had his very informal version. He never rose in official position, excuse me, to the same level as his father, though his father-in-law once said, Julian Amery eventually did not become the foreign minister. He said, "I wouldn't worry about Julian. Julian has his own foreign office."
Oh, interesting. That's intriguing. So no coffee shop. He was just like born, and this is what he wanted to do, and he seemed he was very good at it. So he ended up retiring, but it's after all of this and coming from the family that he came from and fighting in the war, and it's really hard to imagine him retired, just sitting in his backyard cutting roses or something. I don't think that he wrote a lot of books or anything like the others.
No.
How do you think he handled retirement?
I think he was just very busy and involved to the end. I think one of the things I found most interesting about him was that from a very young age, he understood where was most valuable to learn. And so actually very early on in the war, when he was essentially posted to Belgrade, and then later to Cairo, essentially as an intelligence officer, he realized that one of the most valuable things to do is to learn from actually older retired men who may no longer have an official position, and they would be a little bit more candid with you. And he would just listen. He, like Billy McLean, had real relationships, not just contacts. And I don't know that those people ever really retire.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing I was thinking. Like, I don't think that he just sat there and that was the end of it, you know. I wanted to ask you, is there any book that you have in the future that we can expect?
I do. So actually, I have a book coming out comes out in late February in the UK, and it is technically an April release, though I'm told it ships on March 15th in North America. Okay. It is called To Die With Such Men, and it is actually about, I would argue, the successors of these men. It follows a unit of International Legion soldiers who volunteered to fight in Ukraine, to fight arguably the same totalitarian fight that Peter Kemp, David Smiley, Billy McLean, and Julian Amery did. It is a Black Hawk Down style account of one unit fighting in Ukraine. So if that's of interest to you, that will be honest.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about the book. I would love to read that book and maybe have you back on in the future if you're available.
I would love to.
So, yeah. Okay. Thank you so
much. Thank you.